March 7th, Wednesday morning, the second hour at Milton, probing the heart and the soul, Hasidic insights on the Parsha. And this week's Parsha is Parshat Ki Tisa. Ki Tisa. And in order to understand what we're going to learn today, we're going to look at the Mei HaShiloach again, Rabbi Mordechai Liner Mi'Izvich. We don't even have to open up the verse from the Torah in this week's Parsha that he's basing himself upon. The verse simply says, do not make molten gods. Elohei Masecha lo taselecha. And in order to understand, I want to look at the Hebrew, do not make molten gods. So it's on the right-hand side of the page, and it's five Hebrew words, those that are in bold-faced type. Do you see where it says Elohei Masecha lo taselecha? So the word Elohei means gods or idols, and Masecha means molten. Lo taselecha, don't make for yourself. Right? That's pretty simple. Before we begin reading what he says, I want to remind us that we saw his comment on a similar verse about 4 weeks ago when we studied Parshat Yitro, the Parsha of the Ten Commandments. We learned about Anuchi Hashem Elokecha, I'm the Lord your God, in which, according to the Mei HaShiloach, it says, I'm approximately the Lord your God. Remember that? I'm like the Lord your God. I'm kind of the Lord your God. And it was about the fact that the revelation, as we understand it, is always partial and always limited, and therefore always has to be growing. We always have to learn. Every day is like night compared to the next day when we'll learn more. We're always in darkness compared to the illumination that will appear tomorrow. We always have to humbly know that the Torah we know today is nothing compared to the Torah we'll know tomorrow. Everything we have today is only partial truth, and tomorrow there'll be more. But tomorrow also will only have partial truth compared to the next day, and so henceforth forever. That we saw in the words of the Mei HaShiloach on Parshat Yitro, on the words, Anuchi Hashem Lokecha, I'm Lord your God, which he translated again to mean, approximately. It's only approximately and partially the revelation. In that same comment of the Mei HaShiloach on the words of the Lord your God, he went on to explain the second commandment of the Ten Commandments, which was Lo taselecha pesel, don't make for yourself an idol. And he had explained that don't make yourself an idol means don't turn the Torah into an idol. Does he remember that? Anyone remember that? Don't turn the Torah into an idol, which he explained that an idol, as something that is carved in stone, is something that's clear and demarcated with a beginning and end, with boundaries and measurements. Never understand the Torah as something cut and dried, as given and set in stone. Because of what we just said, you always have to know that the truth you have, the understanding you have, the interpretation you have, that you have and the generation has, is only partial, and it's darkness compared to the illumination that will come tomorrow. You have to remember that as we read this. And I just want to say one more thing. I don't think I mentioned, although perhaps I did, when we learned that 4 weeks ago, that when he says, don't make for yourself a pesel, an idol, the word is pesel, did I mention that the word pesel sounds exactly like the English word fossil? It's the exact same consonants? I didn't say that, I think, because I only thought about it the day after. And I thought how fitting it is. He's saying, don't make your Torah into a pesel, into a block of stone that doesn't change. Don't think that the truth you have today is exactly what you have tomorrow. If you take pesel in English, the same letters, fossil, don't make the Torah into a fossil. Don't make it into something that is cast in stone and doesn't develop. Don't think you have all the truth in the back pocket today and you don't have to add. You don't have to add to what you have, because you always have to learn and grow and advance and progress. So, with that information, we go on to what he has to say for today. Elohei Masecha lo taselecha, do not make molten gods. And he says, molten or graven images means principles. What could that mean? Principles. Another translation of the Hebrew word could be generalities. Principles, generalities, rules. I'm going to write on the board all of those different words. To make a molten image means to make principles or rules or generalities. Generalities. And of course, we don't know yet what he is talking about. The verse is saying that at a time when your heart receives an explicit understanding, then do not look to the principles and act according to them. Don't follow the rules. Janice needs a sheet. Rather, you shall know down to the detail how to act according to the understanding of your heart. So let's see the contrast he is pointing out. The contrast between principles, rules, and generalities, as opposed to what? What one word is the contrast to these three on the board? Look in the text. Just tell me one word in this text.
Understanding.
You'd have to then say two words.
Explicit understanding.
Explicit understanding, right? I'm going to write here explicit understanding. And what other word? Explicit understanding. There's one word that everyone knows is the opposite of generalities.
Particular.
Particulars, which, how is it expressed in this English translation? Which word? In this English translation, the top of the page.
Oh, okay.
The very top of the page, we just read four lines. Which one word there is closest to the English word particulars?
Explicit?
The detail?
Details. 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 Okay, so let's understand what he just said. He said, and I'm going to not connect it to the verse that he connects it to. I'm just going to say this in the air. He says that there's a time when you should not conduct your life according to principles, rules, generalities, but you will have explicit understanding of the detail. Okay? Now let me give you an example. An example. Details as opposed to generalities. Principles as opposed to explicit understandings. The principle is, the law is, I can put law here also, the rule is that when you're driving in your car and you come to a red light, you have to stop. Mm-hmm. That's a generality. It's not meant to take into account individual particulars, individual circumstances, explicit, meaning personal circumstances. It's a generality. The law deals with generalities, deals with the collective. It doesn't deal with particular details of circumstance. However, if I have in the back of my car someone who's just been stabbed and is losing blood and I'm running to the hospital, then the particular, the detail is run through the red light and try and save his life. Okay? The generalities don't deal with individual circumstances. The law deals with generalities, principles. And what the Meir Shiloach is doing here, he's setting up the contrast, the tension between the particulars on the one hand and the generalities on the other hand. I'm going to write here particulars. Particulars. Because we all know that for society to function, there have to be rules. And the rules don't take into account, and they cannot take into account, individual circumstances. It could be that if I go through a red light with a pregnant woman in the back, or with someone who's just been stabbed and losing blood, it could be I won't get a ticket, but I broke the law. As far as the law goes, I did the wrong thing. But as far as a focus on my particular circumstances go, I did the right thing. I did the right thing. And we can all point out many, many, many areas in life in which there's this tension between what's good for the individual, what's right for the individual, on the one hand, and the generalities on the other hand, the law on the other hand. For example, I might sign a contract that says I'm going to give you $20 and you're going to give me a new electric toothbrush. I sign a contract on the internet or at the store. I pay my money to get the toothbrush. And the next day, God forbid I have an accident, I lose all my teeth. And I have dentures. I don't need the toothbrush anymore. The law says I have to pay. But as far as my particular circumstances go, it's not fair. It doesn't make any sense. And again, you have this tension between the particulars and the generalities. I can also write here the universals. Let's not write universals. For society to function, we have to obey the law. Right? If everyone finds an excuse to go through a red light, because I have to see my mother, and if I get there late, well, she's going to be very angry with me. Or I have to get this guy to the hospital, or I have to make it on time to the class, or otherwise the students will go home. If everyone makes excuses and does what's right for their particular circumstances, then society will not function and it will fall apart. On the other hand, if we only follow the principles and never take into account particular circumstances, then the guy in my back seat will die of a loss of blood. There's a tension here. That tension is the subject of what we're reading. Let's read it again. Molten or graven images means principles. This verse is saying that at a time when your heart receives an explicit understanding, right, when you know exactly what has to be done for your particular circumstance, then do not look to the principles and act according to them. Don't. Rather, you shall know down to the detail how to act according to the understanding of your heart. So now tell me in your own words, what is he saying? Forget about the verse. Just about, what is he saying about how to live your life?
Creatively.
Good.
Yes.
Good. Let me say provocatively the following. It looks like he's advocating anarchy.
Correct.
Do you understand the radical anarchy that we just read in this verse?
Yes.
This is gewalt. This is unbelievable. This is dangerous. He basically says, if you have to go through the red light, go through the red light. That's what he says. Right? The verse is saying that at a time when your heart receives an explicit understanding, I have to go through the red light because I know my mother has to have me at her home right now. Then do not look to the principles. The principles means the law. And act according. Don't act according to the law. Rather, you shall know down to the detail how to act according to the understanding of your heart. Follow your own heart. Do what's good for you. And don't follow the law. That's what he says. This is terrible. This is unbelievable. This is anarchy. This is dangerous. This is unbelievably radical religious philosophy. Of course I'm exaggerating.
Right.
But I'm just beginning the class. We have another 40 minutes.
But I think he has the, you know, he is the writer. I think in his level, he has so, he is so atone with God that he has even the authority to say, go with your heart.
Good.
Because
good.
He's...
Right, this is not for everybody, but even if we say it's only for the 1% elite who have a direct line to God, they understand through the heart exactly what has to be done, but even for them to say go through the red light, even that's hard. Now, of course, he's not talking about red lights. He's not talking about the American civil justice system. He's talking about the Torah. And he seems to be saying that the Torah is full of, what's the Torah full of? It's full of laws, generalities. When it says in the Torah, do not mix meat and milk, the Torah isn't talking about my particular needs, about a particular person, a particular generation, saying across the board, don't do it. Right? When the Torah says, fast on Yom Kippur. It wasn't talking about individual people, about particular circumstances. It's across the board. It's a law. It's a generality. And he says here that, I'll read it again, at a time when your heart receives an explicit understanding, then do not look to the principles. In other words, if I experience a flash of enlightenment and I hear God say to me, eat pork on Yom Kippur, do it? Is that what he's saying? Do it? It looks like that's what he's saying. And not only that.
Well, he may not be that radical. He may just be.
I hope not.
If you see that you're a person is ill and they shouldn't fast, that you should go ahead and eat.
Very good. Very good. I was radicalizing it. But Carolyn is right. He's emphasizing that individual circumstances may sometimes overrule the generalities of the law. And we really have to figure out how far he means to take it, because he makes a very, very sweeping statement. Right? You did a good job of bringing it back to the mainstream, and you're right.
But he did make a very sweeping statement. But he's saying that don't worship the law.
That's great. That's fantastic. What he's really saying is don't worship the law. Because now let's put it in context. He's saying this is the meaning of the verse, Elohei Maseicha lo taselecha. Do not make golden gods, molten gods. And he's claiming that when you never look at the details, at the particulars, at the individual circumstances, and you only follow the law completely and absolutely in all cases, you apply it as a one-size-fits-all and don't take into account any different circumstances, what you've done, to use Mimi's words, is to worship the law. Whereas he claims that the law is not to be worshipped. He claims that there are times in which God inspires you with an understanding that breaks the law or bends the law, goes beyond the law, or it applies it in a way that the law itself doesn't explicitly say. By the way, I'm almost not sure if I should say this, this radical philosophy reminds us a little bit of the previous class, right? I won't say more.
Definitely.
I won't say more. So, don't make for yourself molten gods when you act and think of the Torah as an unchanging, rigid law that will never take into account individual circumstances, what you've done, again to use Mimi's phrase, you've worshipped the law, you've turned the law into an idol, you've turned it into a molten god. And now we see how this passage connects to the one we saw 4 weeks ago when he said, do not make an idol, and he interpreted it to mean, do not turn the Torah into an idol which is cut and dry and fixed and static. He meant to tell us, rather understand, that revelation is approximate. It's partial. It's always developing. So the same idea we have in that passage, in this passage, not to turn the Torah into a fossil, into an idol, into a one-size-fits-all that always has to apply. There's always going to be, to use what we learned 4 weeks ago, more knowledge and more enlightenment and more understanding. And to use the words of today, there's always going to be changing circumstances and particulars that relate to a particular person, a particular circumstance, a particular time, a particular place. So there's a call here for always learning, always developing, and to taking into account the needs of the individual and not just the needs of the collective, right? Explicit understanding, details, particulars, individual. Individual as opposed to the collective. So we certainly don't know yet how he's going to apply this, because if you take it at face value and run with it, it's the destruction of Judaism. But you understand that? If you take this too far, it's the destruction of Judaism. It says there's no law. Everyone do your own thing.
But isn't inherent in a law the exceptions?
No, it's not inherent.
Take into account that there are exceptions. The law is the law. So I don't find that to be anarchy, because you're recognizing the law. You're just recognizing the mind.
I think
you're not doing it mindlessly.
So I think that what you're saying is good, and you're doing actually what Carolyn did earlier. You're trying to find a less radical interpretation, a less radical application of what he says, whereas I am just going all out here in turning this into something very radical. In the words we read, it's not certain that the two of you are right. Right? In the words we read here, he does seem to be saying, look what he says. He says, don't look to the principles. Don't look to the law. Don't act according to them. So you can take it as radically as I'm taking it. Again, I don't mean to leave this room with my radical interpretation. Otherwise, this wouldn't be Jewish. But it does have within it the seeds of anarchy. Now we'll go on and see how he actually applies it. Before we go on to the next passage, let me just say three things. One is, let's understand his call here. He's calling for allowing Judaism, or allowing individuals within Judaism, to flourish. That we don't want people to feel suffocated by the generalities. He's claiming that there's room for the individual, for my own way, for creativity, as Mimi said earlier, I think it was. That there are going to be special circumstances of the individual, and that does have weight. And you can certainly understand how this claim, this approach, was adopted 100 years after it was written by Rav Shlomo Carbach as the foundation of a way to look at Judaism for our generation. If we're searching for room for the individual, room for personal understanding, room for creativity, room for a sense that I'm not suffocated by the halakha. Okay? Again, it depends how far we take this. That's point number one. Point number two is, I want to point out there's a certain connection here to Purim. Although it's not intentional in the author. It says, Elohei ma'aseicha lo ta'aseh lecha. Do not make molten gods. Do not make molten gods. And what are the molten gods? That's the principles. That's worshiping the principles. Saying there's nothing beyond the law. There's no place for the individual. That's the idolatry of molten gods. The word molten in Hebrew also means mask. Like a mask you put over your face. Which brings us to Purim. How do I connect it more deeply to Purim? Because he's saying that the generalities are a mask. The rules, the principles, the generalities, the law is a mask. It conceals God. It's a mask over God's face. I'm adding my own interpretation here. But it's a mask over God's face. God is really to be found in the particulars, in what's unique for each person. And the law, the generalities, is a mask over God's face. And he's saying that if you only look at the generalities, you're only looking at a mask. And you're mistaking it for the real God. That's why it's idolatry. You're getting God confused with the law. You're looking at God through a mask. And of course, Purim is about revealing what's behind the mask. Okay. That was point number two. Point number three is simply to continue reading and understanding the reference he has concerning Elijah at Mount Carmel. And he says we find an example of this with Elijah at Mount Carmel. The story is as follows. In the book of Kings, there's a story of the prophet Elijah. And he says to the king and to all the idolatrous priests, we're going to do a demonstration. you guys all come, I think it was 400 idolatrous priests, build an altar to your God, put sacrifices on it, and pray for your God to come and consume the sacrifices. And I also will build an altar in the same place, just me, and I'll put sacrifices on it, and I'll pray for my God to come and consume the sacrifices. We'll see whose God is God. And indeed, they have this showdown, and the priests of idolatrous Baal, they call for their God to consume the sacrifice, and nothing happens. Then Eliyahu, the prophet, calls to God, and heaven opens, thunder and lightning come forth, ignites the altar, and all the sacrifices go up in smoke, and that proves that God is God. Except for the following fact. The rabbis point out that it's forbidden to offer sacrifice on an altar outside of the temple. How could Eliyahu have done what he did? It was against the law. It was against the law. And the Talmud says that it was a example of the principle, when it's time to serve God under extenuating circumstances, you can break the law. Think of all that and put it back in our context. He says, everything I said to you, we find an example of this with Eliyahu at Mount Carmel. So it looks like he's extrapolating from Eliyahu at Mount Carmel, who broke the law in order to save the Torah, to save the Jewish people, to prove that God is God, and he's saying that it's a general principle that we should not turn the Torah into a law that can never be broken. We should always leave room for a particular insight of intuition that we have, that we have to follow the details and not just the generalities. We have to take into account individual circumstances. Okay? And again, if we take this at face value, it's anarchy, and it breaks down the Torah, and it's difficult to understand how even this radical thinker could say such a thing. And we understand we'll have to somehow find a way to limit it while still understanding its fundamental message of leaving room for the individual to express himself within Torah and within Judaism. So, in order to go on, we're going to look at the next passage. We won't have time to look at the one on the same side of the sheet. We'll look at the back of the sheet. This is on Parshat Matot, a parsha later on in the book of Numbers. And it's fantastic. It's unbelievably powerful what we're about to read. And Moshe spoke to the heads of the tribes of the children of Israel, saying, "This is the word which God has commanded." Now, that's the beginning of Parshat Matot. And what it goes on to talk about are the laws of vows. The laws of vows and oaths. And basically it says there that if I make a vow, I have to keep my vow. If I make an oath, I have to keep my oath. In other words, you already see how this connects to what we're talking about. Because if the Torah says that if you make a vow, you have to keep it, what it's saying is that your particular decision to take upon yourself a particular way of life, a particular action, has the force of Torah. In other words, it's a way that brings particular circumstances into the framework of the Torah. For example, if I make a vow, according to the laws of vows, and I mention the name of God in the proper fashion, and I vow that I am going to have a potato chip every Wednesday at 9:30 a.m., then it becomes a Torah law that I have to do that. Just like there's a Torah law that I have to fast on Yom Kippur, there's a Torah law now that I have to have a potato chip every Wednesday at 9:30. So this, again, is going to be used by the author as a way to bring the details, the particulars, the individual within the Torah. It's an example, it's an illustration how the Torah does have not just general laws, but also have particular laws. Because in my Torah, as opposed to your Torah, my Torah says you have to have a potato chip at 9:30 in the morning every Wednesday if I made such a vow. And the assumption is, if I made such a vow, I did it on the basis of a deep intuition, understanding. That's what the world needs right now, that I eat that potato chip at a particular time, on a particular day, every week. And of course, my example is facetious, but we should use a different example of something more deep and meaningful. If I take upon myself a vow that I have to, once every 7 years, go to Haiti and work with the impoverished children there, then that's what I have to do, just me, not you, but I have to do that within my Torah. And everyone's Torah will turn out to be a little bit different depending on his circumstance and his time and his place. So now we read. Here we go. All the prophets prophesize with Ko. Thus, like Jeremiah says, thus says the Lord. And Isaiah says, thus says the Lord. Moses was superior to them all, saying, Ze hadavar, this is the word. Moses never said thus. He rather said, at least in our partial reading right now, this is the word. And that's the end of his quote from the Sifrei Matot. The Sifrei is the rabbinic midrash on the book of Numbers, going back 2,000 years. He quotes from that. Now, what does it mean? What's the difference between thus on the one hand and this is the word on the other hand? It doesn't say. The midrash doesn't say. The Meir Shiloach will make of this something stupendous. Moses' level of prophecy occurred only in Moses' generation. Now, that's a mistranslation. So I'm just going to leave that line out. It's a mistranslation. That is to say, all the prophets had a mission to Israel in conveying of their prophecies according to the particular time in which it was said and according to the power of their understanding. They would prophesy within these parameters. So what did he just say? That every prophet prophesies in a very, very, which fashion? On the left-hand side of the board or the right-hand side of the board?
Right-hand
the right-hand side of the board. And every prophet, whether it's Isaiah, or whether it's Zechariah, or whether it's Nahum or Micah, or whoever it is, prophesies according to the particular time, and according to the particular understanding they have, their own circumstances. They see the world through the lenses of their time and of their experiences. Okay. It occurred to them in their prophetic spirit that whichever particular word of prophecy they were speaking was enduring for all eternity. Yet truly there existed changes according to the quality of each generation. What did he just say? He just said the prophets mistook their detailed, particular, individual understanding for a generalized understanding. Do you see what I'm saying? I'll read that again. It occurred to them in their prophetic spirit that whatever particular word of prophecy was speaking was during for all eternity. They were wrong about that. But they mistook the particulars for generalities. On this, Moshe Rabbeinu's level of prophecy was superior to them all, prophesizing with this is the word. Now what you expect him to say is, if you don't read on, now, you probably expect him to say that all the prophets prophesized according to particular circumstances, whereas Moses, his prophecy was for all time. His was the law, the generality. That's what you're expecting him to say, right? Admit it. Right? That's what you're expecting? That's what a good Jewish rabbi would say? But he's not going to say that. He's not going to say that. Rather, look what he's going to say. This is amazing. It blows you away. He says, this means that he understood the prophecy according to its time and place, understanding that a prophecy is only relevant for a particular time, and later God may desire something else. Goodness gracious, what did he just say? He just said that all the prophets are on the right-hand side of the board, and their weaknesses, they don't know it. Moses' greatness is, he's on the right-hand side of the board, and he knows it. You hear that?
Yeah.
That's unbelievable. It's such a deep insight. What it means is the following. That all knowledge is particular. all knowledge is subjective. Anything you know or think you know, whether it's religion or economics, whether it's politics or the military, everything you know is filtered through the lenses of your own personal experience. It's all subjective, it's all particular, it's all time-bound, it's all partial, it can all change. Because you're not God, you're just one particular person. And you might be very intelligent and very wise, but all you have is the glasses you're wearing. All you have is the time you were born. All you have is the era in which you're living. All you have is the parents you had and the education you got and the books you read. It's all through a particular lens. There's no exceptions to that. How do you rise up to greatness? How do you deepen your knowledge beyond that of other people? By realizing the truth of your knowledge, meaning by realizing that your knowledge is particular. The big mistake of all human beings is to mistake their particular subjective knowledge for universal knowledge. If you really want to be wise, if you really want insight, if you really want to understand the world, what you have to do is realize that your knowledge is subjective. And then you will rise above your subjectivity to the degree that you can, simply by realizing that everything you know is only what you know, but it's not necessarily the truth. And then he says the greatness of Moshe Rabbeinu was not that his knowledge was more universal than mine. There's no such thing as universal knowledge. It's all particular for a time, for a place, for a person, for circumstances. But the greatness of Moshe was that he knew that it was only for a certain time and a certain place and a certain person. Of course, you're probably asking, how could we say these things? How does it fit into Torah? I understand, this is totally radical. But that's what he says. There's no other way of understanding what he's saying, I think. That the greatness of Moshe was in the awareness of his limitations, the awareness of his subjectivity, the awareness of his particularity. And Moses didn't make the mistake of assuming that that which is particular is universal. That was his greatness. And that's why he prophesies with the words, "This is the word." In other words, it's only this. It's not more than this. It's only for this time. It's only for this place. That's the greatness of Moshe. He knew we can't go beyond the boundaries of our own particularity. Okay. And the Meir Shiloach says this at the beginning of the parsha that talks about nidarim, that talks about vows. Because vows are an illustration of the particularity of law. There are laws just for particular persons. Only I have to eat a potato chip 9:30 a.m. Wednesday mornings. Only I have to go to Haiti once every 7 years. For me it's Torah, for you it's not. You have your own Torah. That's why he says what he says right as he introduces the matter of nidarim, of vows. Yeah, so we really don't have to read the rest of it. We understand that. So this is beautiful, and this is wildly individualistic, and this is deeply insightful. You can even call it postmodern. But what in God's name does it have to do with Judaism? Because right? We think Judaism is all about law, all about generalities, all about conforming to the commandment, all about accepting the Torah that's eternal. And he seems to have said the Torah is not eternal. Then every generation it changes. Every person has their own insights. God forbid. What can he be saying? We're still here?
Yeah.
Okay, we're still here. Don't leave now. Okay, so now we're going to go on to the passage that I brought here at the bottom. And this hopefully will explain everything. And this is the same Meir Shiloach, right? The same author, the same Rabbi Mordechai Liner. Parshat Masa'eh. Again, at the end of the book of Numbers. And the quote from the verse, the tribe, the Reut, the tribe of the children of Yosef have spoken well. Chein mate b'nei Yosef dovrim. And I'll tell you what the context is. The context is the daughters of Tzlofchad. If you remember, the daughters of Tzlofchad, their father died. And according to laws of the Torah, girls don't inherit. And their father had no sons. So they said, what's going to happen to my father's land? And the law was then given, an individual particular law, that when there's no sons, the daughters inherit. Great, 2 points for the daughters of Tzlofchad. They will inherit. But then, their co-religionists from the tribe of Joseph said, wait a second, if they inherit, and then they'll marry a man from a different tribe, then their land, which belongs to our tribe, will be passed on to their sons, which will be sons of a different tribe, because the tribal affiliation goes according to the father. So how can you allow them to inherit? That means our tribe is going to lose its land. It'll go to a different tribe, to the tribe of the husband they married. And after that protest, then a new particular law was given that these daughters who inherit have to marry someone from their own tribe. Diane, what did you say?
I said arranged marriages.
Well, they can marry whoever they want, but just from the same tribe. Okay, that's the context which the Meir Shiloach is talking about. The tribe of the children of Joseph has spoken well when they said, it's not fair, we'll lose our land, and then the law is given that these girls have to marry from the same tribe. So now let us read what the Meir Shiloach says. Why was the section of the tribe of Yosef's claim written at the completion of the Torah? This is the end of the book of Numbers, and we're calling the end of the book of Numbers the end of the Torah, because the next book, Deuteronomy, is really a separate unit, right? Deuteronomy is really just a compilation of Moses' last speeches. It's a separate unit. So in a certain sense, the end of the book of Numbers, with this parsha of Maaseh, about the statement of the children of the tribe of Yosef, is the end of the Torah. I'll read it again. Why was the section of the tribe of Yosef's claim written at the completion of the Torah? Since it was only a temporary measure for the generation entering the land. In other words, this matter that the girls have to marry from their own tribe was just for then, not for the future. It was a temporary measure. Again, it reminds us of everything we're talking about. Specific temporary measures is to show Israel that not by bread alone does man live, but by all that comes out of the mouth of God does man live. Huh? What's the connection? We all heard of that verse, right? Yeah. Man does not live by bread alone, but by that that comes out of the mouth of God. It's a verse in the book of Deuteronomy. What does it have to do with this? He's going to give us a new interpretation of the verse that will be extremely relevant to this issue. Here we go. Bread symbolizes the words of God, which are the principles. Stop right there. Principles, key word for us. Okay? So bread symbolizes principles. I'm going to put bread right up here.
Bread.
Man does not live by bread alone means that man does not live by generalized law exclusively. There's something more to life than generalized law. Okay, let's go on. Bread symbolizes the words of Torah, which are the principles necessary at all times for all souls without the slightest deviation from the source. That sounds more Jewish. More conformist, right? These are the 613 mitzvot. The whole point is to understand at every moment the will of God in the words of the Torah, knowing His will at all times within the context of that particular time. Ah, so this is something new now. He says that man does not live by bread alone. What does the verse say? Man does not live by bread alone, but by all that comes out of the mouth of God does man live. So, what is the mouth of God? That's the other side of the board.
The particularity.
The particulars, right. Those things that come out of the mouth of God, and he's referring to intuitions that each person might intuit at different times in their life. So man does not live by bread alone, right? Man does live by bread, but not by bread alone. Man also lives by something else, by the mouth of God. And he's telling us, I'll read the sentence again. The whole point is to understand at every moment the will of God in the words of the Torah. Knowing His will at all times within the context of that particular time. In other words, while I do have the generalized Torah that is good for all time and all places, but the whole point is to, within that, understand the particular will of God for me at a particular time, which is that man does not live by bread alone, but also lives by something else. In other words, live by the bread, but add to the bread something else. Live by the generalities and the rules and the particulars. Don't abandon them, as I might have been interpreted to say half an hour ago. Don't abandon them, but add to them another layer of meaning in life. Thus, light emanates from the words of Torah to the hearts of Israel in order for them to understand the depth of the will of God according to the time. According to the time. And I could therefore put on the board here also the will of God.
Well, that's starting to confuse me now, that because both the principles and the laws and all, that's also the will of God.
Fantastic point! Fantastic point! How could we say that the will of God is for the particular time, because that seems to imply that the bread is not the will of God? So the answer of the Meshiloach is indeed that Carol Ann is right. The law is not the will of God. What did I say? He means the following. He means that each person is different. Each person's needs are different. Each person's understanding is different. Each person's circumstances are completely at odds with other people's circumstance. And ideally, every person would have their own Torah, and everyone's Torah would be different. Because the will of God means the perfect life for you, and you're different than me. Everyone's different. What comes out of the mouth of God, the will of God, the individual Torah for you is going to be different than my Torah. However, that cannot be. Because that would be anarchy. We would, paradoxically, if we all had the Torah that was fitting for us as individuals, there would be wonderful, there would be perfection, it would actually be our downfall. There would be anarchy, there would be no cohesiveness, no family structure, no community, no nation, none of the collective meaning that really makes life significant. We would be individuals, atoms, in our perfect worlds, unconnected to anyone else. And therefore, says the Meir Shiloach, God created bread. The bread is edible by all. It has rules and regulations for everyone to follow. And like you said, at all times, at all places. But God created the bread not because all of the principles and rules are what I need at any particular time. They're not. Because everyone is different. No, the Torah certainly has within it rules that ideally shouldn't apply to me. Or should apply to me today, but not tomorrow. And it should apply to you yesterday, but not the day before. Or should apply in the 1800s, but not in the 1900s. But the Torah, in order to create generalities, compromises. And it creates a rule that is the best possible rule for widely divergent individuals and widely divergent times and widely divergent places. It's the best possible Torah that can be. It's the perfect Torah. Except for the fact that by definition, generalities aren't perfect. Because they don't take into account individual circumstances. So the Meir Shiloach is not saying abandon the Torah. He's not saying do whatever you want. He's not saying don't follow the rules. He's saying follow the rules. But understand that while you're following the rules, they're not necessarily the best rules for you at any given time. They're really not. But rules have to be followed. There have to be rules to create a society, to create a nation, to create cohesiveness, to create meaning, to create bond between people. There has to be a society of rules and regulations. But that society of rules and regulations, which has to be, and the Torah is the best possible set of rules and regulations, but it's still at tension. It's still at odds. And this is the very nature of it. It's always going to be, to a certain degree, at odds with the needs of a certain person at a certain time. But that's not, nothing you can do about that. That's the very nature of law. What we have here is a very deep analysis of the tension between different levels of human need. There are human needs that relate to the individual, and they're all different. But then there's the human need for connection to other human beings and for the creation of a society. And that requires law, so the individual needs the law. But at any given time, the law is not going to be exactly what he needs for his personal soul. And you have to live with that tension. You have to accept that tension. There's going to be laws of the Torah you have to follow, even though they really don't apply to you. And they don't help your spiritual circumstances. And they don't advance your cause. They don't advance your connection to God. But you have to maintain the framework. But once you have that framework, remember that man does not live by bread alone. And you have to search for the circumstances and the places and times when you can have your own personal way without breaking the system. But you have to search for that. It's not enough to accept the Torah blindly and then just do what everyone else does. He doesn't want you to be a robot. Doesn't want you to be like everyone else. Doesn't want mere conformity. He wants you to live with the tension between conformity and individuality. So it's a narrow bridge, right? And it's not easy. But, and it creates conflicts because I always have to ask myself, is it time for me to search out my particular way? And how do I do it in a fashion that doesn't conflict with the general law? I have to live with that tension. So it's difficult, and it's a narrow bridge. On the other hand, it certainly could be interpreted as providing a breath of fresh air for those individuals who are struggling to find themselves within the Torah and find it suffocating, and find it just so all-encompassing that it snuffs out their sense of self and their sense of individuality and their sense of creativity. So says the Meir Shiloach, don't let it snuff out that sense of creativity and individuality. Search within the framework for the particulars for you, for the individual way for you. And that's not against the Torah. That's what the Torah wants. It wants you to search out those particularities that are just for you. And let's just read the rest of the statement. So we had read, I'll begin from the sixth line at the end, the seventh line at the end. The whole point is to understand at every moment the will of God in the words of Torah. And the will of God means the particulars. What's for you? We're on Parshat Masa'eh, right? At the bottom there. at the beginning of a new line. Thus light emanates from the words of Torah to the hearts of Israel in order for them to understand the depth of the will of God according to the time. Search for the particulars for your time, for your place. Therefore, this section was written after the completion of the entire Torah in order to let Israel understand that details emerge from the Torah at all times of each moment. In other words, after the Torah is finished with all its generalities, it has at the end a particular to tell you that there's more particulars to come. There's more individual circumstances that have to be understood and interpreted to find the will of God for that particular time and place and person. The words of the Torah are words of advice to let man understand what the blessed God wants of us now and to do it right now. You want to find beyond the bread, you want to find the words of God that are from the mouth of God for you in particular. Therefore, this section was written at the end for this. It too is active for only a specific time. The matter of the girls not marrying beyond their tribes is active only for a specific time to teach you that once the Torah is written with its generalities, there's always going to be new particulars you have to discover that are only for a certain particular time and a certain particular person, only a particular place, and you have to be involved in that constant search for the particulars, and don't let the bread be all you eat all the time. Yes, bread, but add to it the spice of life, the spice of the individual, which is that which comes forth in the word of, from the mouth of God.
That means that today that we are in 2012, we have the particular, we have the principles, we have the generalities of that Torah written more than 3,500 years ago. But how we are going to apply it today is going to be a consensus of what we are living today.
But see, he doesn't say how to do it.
Right.
That's right. That's the
so that means
most
that we
thing.
We the people are going to look for that particular way to do it, because I know I cannot do any work on Shabbat, but unfortunately I don't live in the Eruv area, and I need to take, I can do two things. I have never going to be on Shabbat, never, because I need to, probably I need to take from 5 a.m. to walk and be there. Or I can use the vehicle to do it. So I am breaking probably the rules of igniting and driving, but at the same time, because for me was more important to be listening for that Shabbat, I will do that. I will change things.
I hear what you're saying. I am not going to comment upon the how. He didn't comment upon it. I'm not going to comment upon it. But to me, what's important is the principle. Right, the principle that it's not only, it's not a bad thing, but it's a good thing to search for what it means to me, to search for the new aspect of it that goes beyond what already is given and written and beyond what everyone else does. It's a positive thing to search for my particular understanding and my particular way and my particular aspect of it. And of course, the minute you open the door to the individual, well, you open the floodgate to all different types of things, and someone might violently disagree with what you said with your particular take, but the Me'er Shiloh opened the door to the individual searching for his particular aspect and understanding of things.
And tomorrow will be different. Tomorrow we will have another set of things, but
different for you and for me.
When you have the principle, when you have the generalities, that has never going to change. That is going to be there.
He says it's never going to change.
And that is the Torah. The way we can, in 2200, probably, will be something happen. Something can happen and can evolve in a way that we will have the Schlesinger, some of them will continue. some of the Chabad will continue, but probably something new, not just the reform, will be there.
Could be.
That is what is talking about the changing to the times?
Changing to the times, yes. But again, the particular form it takes, he doesn't say, and the door is open.
Good.
Thank you very much.
Everyone should have a very happy Purim.
Thank you.
And remember, get drunk, but only once a year, not before and not after.